So I live in Maine. I've kind of always been from somewhere else. My father lived here in town on West Chestnut Hill Road, and my mother lived in Ohio. So when I was in Ohio, I was from Delaware, and when I was in Delaware, I was from Ohio. And that's probably a good foundation for the amount of time I spend on the road now. I like to make the analogy that I'm in kind of like a terrible band where I have no fans except for a few former teachers and some family. So, which is fine by me, but it's a lot of time on the road, and I was hoping to share a couple of things today that were more about kind of personal growth and project work. And if we have time, we can dive into some of the assignment work that I do. But after journalism school, I went and worked at a newspaper in Florida for a few years as a general assignment photographer, which is between 2 and 5 assignments a day, where the spectrum of what you see can be pretty pronounced. I mean, you can have. I always talk about you could photograph a funeral in the morning and the mayor at noon and a hamster race at the local pet store in the evening, and you really have to be able to switch gears pretty quickly and turn around, synthesize what you're doing, synthesize a story, and turn it around fairly quickly on deadline, on demand. And after a few years of doing that, I was a little bit not worn out, but I was looking forward to trying to work with a bit more intention and trying not to be so I tried not to be as reactive with my work. So I decided to go freelance and was talking to my father, who had recently retired from the university here, and we talked about possibly. We daydreamed about maybe moving out west together. And I moved to Colorado with sort of abstract hopes of that coming true, and then my father fell ill and passed away. And so as a general assignment photographer, I was both grieving and also kind of trying to find my own voice, and became obsessed with finding out a little bit more information about my father. And so I hit the road for a few months and traveled throughout the American West in some of the landscapes that were particularly important to him during his life. And he was a great storyteller, so I had this trove of stories that I could rely on, but kind of no specifics. And I had a very patient wife who went with me and tolerated me, pacing around and being self-absorbed. What I did find as I traveled around the country wasn't so much him in the landscape, but more of myself. And I became really, I found my focus. When I first got into this, I thought I was going to go cover war and conflict when I first became a photographer. And I realized that what I truly enjoy are wild places and being by myself, I think. And looking for ways to have larger conversations about land use and land ethics and culture and the intersection between culture, economy, and the landscape with the work. These photos never went anywhere, by the way, too. This is all just personal work. And it was a step back professionally to take time off, but it was also much needed, not just for the grieving process, but also because I was a little bit disillusioned with daily news coverage. The Colorado theater shooting in Aurora happened when I was out there, and I was looking at I almost got published by Time magazine for it, right? And I had never been published by anybody of that caliber. And I remember working long hours, day after day after day, with a pack of other photographers, and really not being Well, being mildly ashamed, I'd say, actually, of the reality of having to cover something like that, where you have to set aside your own how you behave around people to satisfy deadlines, and the application of like the free market system and a struggling freelancer in the context of such tragedy, I found to be really not just exhausting, but just a little bit of you kind of dies with that. And when I remember sending the director of photography at time what I'd been doing, and then there was this kind of abstract promise that this was going to go in the magazine, and I was really happy about that. And then it didn't, and then I was really upset about that. And then I took a deep breath, and I thought, oh my gosh, like, I don't know how you get to that point where you don't, where you want to succeed on something like that, or on the back of something like that. And so I, you know, the combination of those two things made me realize that I needed to focus, and I needed to have something that meant more than just my next deadline. I don't see a difference between my photography and myself. And so the difference, trying to figure out and trying to analyze the person that I am rather than the person like I think I should be, if that makes sense. And I don't want to turn this into like a navel gazing, like I'm so sad. Like I'm not, I'm good. But I did, there in 2013, I did find the connection I was looking for, which was in a lot of ways has a lot to do with my dad too. Even though I was looking for him in that landscape, I realized that a lot of his worldview, I was really proud to adopt that legacy and continue that legacy. And I just needed to distill that a bit more. So I found, through an assignment with Wall Street Journal, I discovered the Ogallala Aquifer. So the Ogallala Aquifer is an enormous underground body of water that stretches from southern South Dakota to the Texas Panhandle. And included in that is Nebraska, obviously South Dakota, Kansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Texas, Wyoming, Colorado. And people have called it an underground ocean. I think that's a little bit misleading. It's an aquifer is just wet dirt, essentially. But it's responsible for, what is it, 1/5 of all agricultural production in the United States. Cotton, wheat, corn, beef, sunflowers, and a number of other things. And when I was, I just couldn't believe the economic implications something like that would have. And I was fascinated with this idea of the thread of natural history being responsible, you know, the idea of connecting natural history to civilization. I was also a little bit ashamed of myself when I realized how enormous it was, and how I had no understanding of it, even though I had been working atop of it for quite some time. And so I set about, in my spare time, in between assignments, in between moving, in between various editorial commissions, trying to create a body of work that would explore these intersections between people and the landscape. You know, how does a layer of wet dirt that's 1,800 feet below the surface, how is that responsible for the kid working at Taco Bell? You know, like how do you bridge those connections? And that's what I set out to do. So I'm going to show you the first part of the first chapter of this, which is almost primarily landscapes and aerials. This is a work in progress. If you don't like it, keep it to yourself. Or, but no, please feel free to ask any questions. As I roll through this too, if there's time, I'm happy to show you some of the assignment work I do as well. But so in this vast American desert that was called in the early 1900s land that was wholly unfit for cultivation. But if you look back at 1540, Coronado takes his army and marches north out of Mexico and wanders onto the high plains. And they're searching for the city of gold. And so it's this vast, featureless, dry expanse with extremely disorienting. The guide purposely leads them around, leads him the wrong way to try to spare some of the tribes from his wrath, but he eventually ends up in Kansas and is introduced to the tribe, the Kavira tribe, which the city of gold that he was looking for was also called Kavira, but obviously there was no gold in western Kansas in 1542. And so he slaughters his guide and marches his men back to Mexico. What he didn't realize what was underneath his feet. It wasn't until the late, I think 1898, when a geologist outside of Oglala, Nebraska, is working outside of town and notices in some of the striations that are exposed, he notices this pink sediment layer. A few years later, he's down in Texas working in the panhandle. He notices the same pink sediment layer and then goes on to realize that it's all connected. So part of what I'm trying to do is explore this idea of land management, which is about the most unsexy thing you can ever tell an editor. Like when you're talking about your project, like, what's your project about? And I'm like, land management. And they're like, oh, is it about climate change? I'm like, no. It's land management, and they're like, oh God, no, we're not going to do this. But like, I am interested in this idea of the myth of the Western landscape in terms of it being wild and untamed. It is vast, but it is highly managed. And I'm not sure if Mark Twain said it. I tried to Wikipedia it before I did this, but the whole... The quote of around here, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, holds true. So in this vast expanse of land that is highly managed and very fluid, you have Nebraska holding the majority of the aquifer, and the water table there is fairly healthy. The further south you go, you are looking at a diminishing water table because of agricultural production, and the more efficient we get with farming, such as the center pivot irrigation system, which really kind of expanded like heavily and changed the entire entire Western landscape in the 1970s. The more efficient you have your instruments are, the more you can actually do. It's like when the iPhone came out, and they're like, look at all you can do. You know, it's going to be so much faster. Well, you just have to do that much more. And so the it scaled up production, and now you're talking about areas in Texas and New Mexico and Kansas and Oklahoma that are running dry. I always say, you know, to talk about saving the aquifer is not about necessarily saving a layer of wet dirt. It's to talk about saving ourselves. And looking at that landscape and looking how people have changed it over the last few hundred years is something to behold. You know, something even as simple as shifting from bison to cattle. Bison will move in a herd and tend not to follow like in single file. So in a place like here, Plainview, Texas, you see the impact of cattle following each other in lines. They tend to go in single file. And that can have generational implications for the landscape. It's just just strictly in terms of evidence. I'm not anti-cattle in Plainview, Texas, but just in terms of evidence of like how people impact that landscape. An interesting fact about Plainview as well is the Ogallala was responsible for almost for most of the settlement on the High Plains, and that was brought about because of railroads. Railroads needed rail stations in order to refuel their steam engines. And so there was a concerted effort to propagandize how great life was out on the High Plains. So in Plainview, Texas, for instance, they tapped the aquifer and filled up a lake in town and then advertised it to folks back east as this paradise on the plains and sailboats. And people went out in droves. Well, the pumps broke about 4 years later. The lake dried up, which is, so, and it hasn't been there since. This is a similar situation in the Sand Hills in Nebraska, which is a different climate. The Sand Hills is the primary recharge point for the Ogallala. This is the area that, like, if the Keystone Pipeline would go through and, say, break, it would contaminate the aquifer. And the economic implications of something like that are profound. Again, just, I'm trying to find the textures and the patterns of that are, in a way, evidentiary to what we depend on to sustain ourselves. And that can range from agriculture to oil and gas. Outside of Midway, Odessa, Texas, you had, it was traditionally, there's a lot of oil exploration. Well, now they're transitioning to fracking. So there's an enormous infrastructure and holding area ready to mobilize to go out into the landscape to further feed the machine, as well as suburban sprawl. Just to talk a little bit about process, I opted to photograph this using film, using a pretty ancient Hasselblad camera, because I'm Polish and I like to do things the hard way, especially when it comes to aerials. So if you hang out the side of a plane with a Hasselblad, it's about the most inefficient way to ever work. But for those of you who knew my father, I think he could appreciate that. I chose to photograph this project in black and white too because of the topographical variation in the landscape, and I was worried that between the seasons and the landscape itself, that if I didn't unify it through process, that it could get a little bit confusing, and people wouldn't realize that it was all connected. Looking at feedlots and big business, this is what a friend editor of mine calls Calschwitz, which is it's a terrible joke, but it's also it's amazing the scale of the agriculture and out there, and like what that's an entire another conversation when you talk about like the myth of farming or the myth of like. When it's not a myth of farming. I live in Maine, where actually it's exactly like it looks. It's almost storybook. but when you look at the big farms out west, and you know, and the schools all have like their Monsanto wings of the Monsanto Gymnasium or the Monsanto Award for 4-H, or I guess seeing the connective threads of influence and motivations between institutions such as our public schools and big business is something that I'm, yeah.
Can you just go back?
Sure.
So I'm guessing that all those little dots are each one is a cow.
Yes.
So that's a gigantic feedlot, and as I understand it, there are 13 states in the U.S. where taking that picture is illegal.
Yes.
So what did you just take it and not tell anybody, or is this not a state where that's from, or what?
I told the pilot. that's a good point. They call those ag gag laws, and Kansas is notorious for that. And there's a National Geographic photographer who just got into a bunch of trouble. He launched a glider and was taking photos of farm, I guess, of feedlots, and was arrested for it. A lot of those laws are really meant to limit people's access to the practices and the view of that. And they say it's bad for business, but I think there was a few years back where a drone operator actually in Texas photographed blood from a feedlot spilling into a waterway, and they were most concerned with the fact that the drone operator took the photo as opposed to the blood spilling in. Yeah.
But what's the given rationale for outlawing photos like that?
It's bad for business.
They say that?
They say that people cannot handle the truth of where their food comes from, and that it infringes on their capacity to make a living and their rights to work as they please. Now, in Texas, I'm actually able to take that photo. In Kansas, I am not. So between the laws in terms of my access, but also in terms of even water usage, Texas water rights are different from Kansas's water rights, which are different from Oklahoma's, different from New Mexico's, different from Wyoming's, and different from Nebraska's and South Dakota's. But the aquifer does not pay attention to state boundaries. And so where a place like Texas, which values private property rights perhaps more profoundly than other places, if it's under your feet, it is yours, which goes back to English common law, which is up to heaven and down to hell. You own the rights. That same theme is actually, I'm applying that to a body of work I'm working on fracking now, which is a segue I don't need to go into, but it's go ahead.
I've written about this issue a lot. I've never understood the intent of the law. So is it illegal for you to take it, or is it illegal for you to publish it? Like, if you...
It depends on the state. It's not illegal for me to take that picture in Texas or publish it. I also don't think that they would be able to figure out which one it was. So no, they wouldn't know if there was an opportunity to go after me. It'd be hard to figure out exactly where it was to do that. But I don't have the I would never do that in Kansas because I could not afford the legal ramifications of that. Nebraska, you can do whatever you want. So it really does vary. And a great resource for familiarizing yourself with the laws, if you don't want to dive into the legalese, is to talk to the pilots. And the best way to access pilots at an affordable rate are flight schools, for anyone who's interested in ever doing that. One of the best pilots I had was in Wyoming, who used to be an Air Force guy, but he was attached to NASA, and so he worked in mission control, and I've never felt so safe. A lot of my other work is way more intimate in terms of portraiture, in terms of talking with folks and trying to convey a sense of personality. And with this, I'm really trying to step back and take a look at evidence and structures and see if I can find a narrative in that, which is challenging for someone like me because I feel like I'm fairly personable and I don't have a problem typically gaining access. But one of the hesitations I had with making individuals prominent characters in this project was that it seemed to be a bit of a false intimacy. It's such a vast, expansive area and territory that to put a face on it, it didn't seem like an appropriate thing. So an appropriate way to work. So I purposely have been avoiding photographing individuals close in a way that could say, that could tether that person's identity, I guess, per se. I think that, one of the realities of being a newspaper or a magazine photographer is that I will often get tasked with going into a town, say in Maine, where the mill has closed down, and you've got a deadline of the next day or that night to try in the best way you can summarize a community, which is really, really challenging. So it becomes more of a circumstantial project where if you'll go to the town in Maine and the paper mill closed, and whoever crosses my line of sight is the person that I need to say, excuse me, I'm a photographer working for the New York Times, and I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the mill and what that means, and then they will become the face of this thing. And that's just the reality of deadline work. I don't know how to get around that, but since I do have time to work on this and to plug away at this, I'm much more interested in the stuff that I don't get to do in the context of my assignment work. Another thing I'm really interested with this is the idea of not just water usage, because I don't know if you noticed, but there hasn't been a single picture of water yet because it's underground. But I'm also interested in this idea of sort of the passive complicity of environmental impact. So if you're plugged into the grid, and I'm the first one to, I mean, I drive a lot for my work. I burn a ton of fossil. My carbon footprint is probably equivalent to, you know, half the people in this room put together. And that really, I want to engage with people about that. Not just myself, but in terms of if you're plugged in, you know, if you're keeping the lights on the cross all night, or if you're, it's basically almost all of our activities, like we're sort of all part of the problem, right? And the, whether you're talking about fresh water, or whether you're talking about fossil fuel consumption, or whether you're talking about fossil fuel consumption that comes from this place where fresh water is precious, which is sort of the, you've got both things going on the Ogallala. These kinds of things I find fascinating. You know, another myth about agriculture too, or not a myth, but one of the things I did not understand was just how high tech it is. I don't know how many of you guys have been in a modern combine, but it is incredible. It's like the space shuttle. Satellite guided that stores data from, say, like the last 20, 30, 40, 50 plantings, if they're doing two plantings a year. And the satellite will actually guide the tractor, say, an inch to the left and rotate it 5 degrees so you're not planting in the same hole. And so the driver of the combine, the farmer, will turn the tractor around and then hit auto, and the tractor does everything for you via the satellite. It'll also fertilize. It'll keep records oftentimes of crop yields, and it can adjust fertilization intensities according to which parts of the field were more productive or less productive in a way to try to even it out, which I just find fascinating. It's the growing disconnect between our food and the things that we need to maintain our civilization. The growing disconnect is something that I find really interesting as well. This body of work is also up at Westchester University right now. I installed it last week, and if there is something that you guys want to look at a little bit more, you're welcome to go to the Naur Gallery and check it out. A huge transition to wind energy too in West Texas. It's like a lot of things. I mean, even like oil and natural gas, is there's not it doesn't employ a ton of people, but it is interesting to watch that landscape change. And in talking with folks out there, there seems to be not the same kind of. It's almost like people are nostalgic for oil and gas. It's interesting and don't necessarily in casual conversations don't necessarily view the wind farms with the same level of appreciation. So it's kind of an interesting like cultural dynamic going on with that. How this all formed was basically the eastern slopes of the Rocky Mountains, where eons of erosion pulled debris, sediment, boulders, rocks, and spread them across the plains. So looking at, for the first time, and I have no level of expertise in any of this, like I'm terrified there's like a geologist in the crowd that is going to, but looking at how something so massive and happened so long ago is such a determining factor in what we enjoy today. Like even the food here, like right now, is there beef in any of that? I mean, it's kind of because of this. or there's like a high statistical chance that there is, or even like Cold War era missile silos. The idea that you could have something as precious as groundwater that was so vital to the national economy and national security, to have something like nuclear warheads posed over top of it. These are shuttered. They wouldn't let me fly over that if it wasn't. But
wonderful photograph. So let's give Tristan a big round of applause. That was amazing. Having tried to shoot before out of a plane, I know it's no easy task, especially with a Hasselblad. So kudos to you. So my bigger question, though, was how do you keep going with taking such powerful images and seeing some of the environmental impacts that you've seen? So what is it that just keeps you motivated to keep shooting and telling the story?
I'd say that it's definitely not for the money. Because that's not a reality. I think that, you know, I like the idea of not like the idea. I think what keeps me going a lot of it is like honoring my father's legacy. You know, I think that he was such a model of rebellion, of taking examining an issue, examining like intersections between culture and policies, and he was a ceramic sculptor. For those of you, just to give you a little background, he was a ceramic sculptor who did very realistic sculptures of everyday objects that were tethered to the working class or were statements on like a material culture, and became, I guess what would be the best word? They became, he was making larger statements about our value systems. And I think that something like that, I knew that I could never fill his shoes in the context of ceramics or sculpture. But I wanted to, I want to continue, my whole worldview is basically just his. And I don't think, there are a lot of people that are angry at their parents. I am definitely not one of those people. And I'm really proud of all the work that he did and the impact that he had and the conversations that he started with his work. The idea of material culture, the idea of throwing something away as opposed to fixing it or repairing it. A lot of his work had to do with that. The idea of mass consumerism, overconsumption. All these things come into play. So on one level, I'm just genuinely interested in it. And I like thinking about why we do what we do and what forces inform that, both structural and cultural. From settlement patterns to private property rights to motivation, like profit motivations and whatnot. On a personal level, it's totally to try and do my best to not embarrass my old man.
I'm just curious. You've shot for the New York Times, Mother Jones, Audubon, Bloomberg, Wall Street Journal. Is there a photo you will not take?
Well, yeah, I managed to strip all sexuality. Can I say that on the radio? I managed to strip all sexuality out of my work. Not necessarily intentionally, but I'm just like. So I when there have been some accusations flying around about photographers being scoundrels on the sets, I was the least worried. You know, going back to the Aurora Theater shooting in Colorado, that's the last time I'll do that. I think, it's not that I don't think that those photographs are necessary, but I don't think that 40 of us standing shoulder to shoulder, all shooting the same picture, is necessary. I think that coordination and empathy and the marriage between who you are and what you do is really important. So if there's a major news event and I have to go cover it, I really try to walk, I try to walk softly. I try to treat people as I'd like to be treated. I try to be very respectful. And it's never been an impediment to achieving any kind of closeness with folks. And I think people can pick up on that. So, I guess that. I would be a terrible advertising photographer because I have no idea how to recognize, I can only sort of recognize something that's interesting, but never flattering. And so, but that's not really what you're asking, so.
I'd like to follow up really on both of those questions. So I've seen you now give versions of this presentation three times today. And they are, without exception, visually wonderful and interesting. And I'm trying to figure out what emotional energy is behind them, knowing very well the content about what you're trying to talk about, because I write about the same stuff. And my response tends to be full of a kind of a burning anger and grief over, the things, in case those of you in the audience are not hip to this, there's a fairly serious environmental catastrophe going on right below the surface, actually, literally, of these photographs. But the energy here is really of aesthetic beauty. And I wonder if you could just talk about how, I'm not a photographer, I'm a writer, and I'd like to hear you talk about the way that beauty and trauma, or whatever you want to call, intersect, and how you make those choices and put whatever you call your emotional content into these images, knowing what you know about what lies behind them.
That's a good question. So I think when it comes to aestheticizing a very serious issue, I try to do it with intention. So keep in mind this frame of eastern Wyoming, and this is basically the building blocks for the Ogallala. Well, first of all, the doing aerials is kind of an easy way to get people interested in an issue. It's highly visual. And I think that when you want to have these larger discussions, it's important to get people to look at it. So if you keep that in mind, and then if you look at this, here, 1 second. So this is a story I shot for the New York Times on the National Wildlife Repository, which is it's a warehouse outside of Denver, Colorado, packed with illegal animal parts and contraband, all seized at major ports of entry around the United States. All these objects are sort of inherently horrifying. I needed to figure out a way to photograph them to where it was aestheticized just enough to engage people, not over horrify people, acknowledge the evidentiary qualities of these objects, and there's just a lot going on, right? And so I'd seen some work done out there before that was highly visual. It looked like a nightmare more than it was. But you have to show restraint, I believe, and finding that right balance. I always make, and this will be the third time you've heard this today, I always make the analogy to cooking. Just because you have all the spices in your cupboard does not mean you need to throw them all in to the soup. And so with something like this, I tried to think critically about what would be the best way to get the most people to look at this without either celebrating them or without turning people off and letting the objects speak for themselves. So with most of my work, if something interesting is happening, it's not rocket science. Like, I've been doing this for 15 years, almost 15, I guess, and there's a certain, you react, the light is nice, the, you know, there's a moment, you've got your composition down, you can, you're just there, and you know, at a certain point, like, even pushing the button on your camera long enough that you understand it. Doing work like this, to me, is the most difficult part, because everything has to be intentional, and you have to vary your the subject matter between things that are exotic and things that are fairly normal. So something like this, where, you know, an elephant had its leg cut off and turned into a footstool, the economy of that versus the economy of, say, like, just what's the difference between this and a deer head, aside from the, you know, a deer mount, the rarity of it. To me, that's I don't have any answers. I'm not a vegetarian. I eat a ton of meat. I've eaten burgers from the Ogallala, but I also am. I also. But I also, I think there's a certain amount of we can be a barbaric species. One of the books that McKay made me read when I was a college student was Barry Lopez's Arctic Dreams. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that book, but I highly recommend it. And there's, I think, one of the quotes from the book that I lean on almost with every project I do now is, I'm going to butcher the quote, but it has to do with him talking to an Inuit hunter north of the Arctic Circle. And he says that they looked at white people with a combination of, like, awe and incredulity, whereas they see themselves as a part of the natural world, and they see us as people that can create massive changes to the landscape and the natural world, and because of our technology, we've managed to distance ourselves, perhaps to a detrimental point. And so their word for us, translated, is the people who change nature. And I'm finding that almost every project I do, whether it's for the Times, whether it's on the Ogallala, whether it's fracking in Pennsylvania, or whether it's working for Audubon, I'm seeing the same theme over and over and over and over again. And I don't have any answers, but I do think that I'm trying to arm myself with the tools to ask the questions and at least acknowledge. Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. So I'm actually also a Berkeley alum, so go Bears.
Yeah.
Sorry. I guess my question for you is, so you went from doing, like, you got your bachelor's in English, right, and then you got your journalism degree, and then after Berkeley you were like, well, I saw that you were like a busboy and you were shucking oysters and all that. And I guess my question to you is, like, how did you find direction in your life to, like, lead you in the path that you chose, right? Because it seems like you had a lot of various interests, maybe they all intersected somehow, but it's like, for me as, like, a young person in this economy and, like, with interest in art, but just the real picture being, like, hey, I need money, like, how did you make that transition, and what were, like, I guess the pros and cons of, like, maybe pursuing what you're passionate about versus staying in, like, a secure and stable job that's going to give you that, you know, but basically security moving forward?
Well, I think there's something, I am privileged. How about that? You know, I had parents that loved me and supported me. My father taught here, so I was able to go to school here. And so I think that's a huge part of it. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, about all the legs up and opportunities I've had, and, like, trying not to mess that up. And, like, we weren't wealthy per se, you know, and, like, I had a lot of chores and I worked a lot. But I think that there's something to be said about having the freedom to find yourself that, like, I don't think a lot of people have. So that's a huge part of it. Another part, and what that allowed me to do was basically follow my intuition. I've made a ton of decisions that weren't necessarily resume builders, But I just felt like the right thing to do. When I met my wife and my future wife and my present wife, my only wife, I think, in Florida, she was going to Washington, D.C., and I had a really cushy staff job at a newspaper. And I was like, I'm in love. I'm out of here, you know? And I went to D.C., and I fell on my face. And, you know, I had, like, one assignment in 2 years, and I messed that up. It was awful. It was embarrassing. And I only got the assignment because I had a friend who was an editor, you know, so I embarrassed him. But over the years, I've always had a place to come back to and recharge, and that was here. You know, my father owned a property up on West Chestnut Hill Road, like I said, and I could come back. I could, you know, I had mentors I could talk with. I had support, and that's so important. You know, I think that there's institutional support in some other places, you know, where you feel free to do these things, and society supports that, but not necessarily to the same extent here. And so a lot of it has to come down to family. I always tried to work the entire time, so even if, you know, I would go, you know, months without an assignment, so I'd pick up a job landscaping or working construction or shucking oysters, which is the worst job. Like, don't get me wrong, I love oysters, but good God, you know. And I quit when I stabbed myself in the thumb, like, very, like, right, you know, I'm out of here, you know. But it's been one of those kind of winding paths that that I feel very fortunate, you know. And as I've become an adult and figured out through, you know, through family, through friends, through being obsessed with the craft and with, you know, just a great set of mentors and become independent, having, being able to go back and forth with my wife to lean on each other from time to time. When I first moved to D.C., I didn't make any money, you know, for a long time. And she made the money. We moved back to Florida and it came back to me, and then I was working regularly back at the newspaper. You know, we moved to Colorado, and it was half and half. And she ended up with a job at Summit County, and then recently it's been me, but we're a unit. And she just finished nursing school, which is about the most stable sector of the economy. And so that's a huge part of it. I have friends and colleagues where they're both working photojournalists, and it's so challenging. You know, they're competing for the same assignments, and so we take turns going back and forth with financial responsibilities. And so I've never wanted to have a great distinction between personal life and professional life. I've always wanted to move in the direction that I'm now that I've moved, but I can't take credit for it. I can I did the best I could with what I had, though. Yeah.
Curious about the economics of this project.
Yeah.
You've been showing us. Did you have a grant to go out and do all these photographs? Did you have an advance from a book publisher? Are you just living off your wife for now, or how did it?
She just graduated like 3 weeks ago. No, I'm not living off her yet, but I will. No. Something like this is commissioned by the New York Times.
All those geology and that land management.
I had money saved, and I was also going back and forth quite a bit to that part of the country, because we had left in recent years. So I was able to lean on that, and then use the money from my commissions in order to fund it. I tried to get interest in it. But like I said, tell an editor about a project on land management and watch their eyes glaze over.
Do you have a book title that's different from land management?
I've been working with Sweetland.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. We have time for one last question.
I'm just curious if you can talk about why you chose black and white for images of natural landscapes.
Yeah, I chose black and white because I was looking to unify such a vast area of land, both in terms of topography, in terms of ground cover, and in terms of season. the difference between winter, spring, summer, and fall is highly pronounced. I also wanted to pluck a nostalgic string with the audience, just a hair. I was interested in this idea of, I run into people all the time who are like, you know, the only real photography is black and white photography. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But I think that there's something accessible about that, that I really want my work to be accessible. But I also want my work to be, let's go as deep as you want. Like, if you want to talk about, you know, why I chose like a two-tone backdrop for this, why I chose to light it like this, why I chose these compositions for, you know, objects, I could go on for an hour and it will be the cure for insomnia. But it was 2 weeks of, you know, wringing my hands and, you know, cussing and trying things out before we figured out a workflow to make that happen. So with all of my work now, like, the more, I'm trying to be so much less reactive than when I started, and so much more intentional. I don't know if I'm successful with that, but I've got the microphone, so.
On that note, Tristan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.